Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
A very good morning to you. It's Wednesday, April 8. Welcome to this edition of Africa Link. I'm Jessie Wingard in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, after the Garissa attack, human rights groups fear that Kenyan security forces could overreact.
After this Garissa attack, the Kenyan government may pursue the same strategy that they've used in the past and target civilians as well as the Al-Shabaab militants.
An International Monetary Fund bailout deal could still mean economic hardship for Ghanaians.
Ordinary man out there who is expecting some employment here and there may not get it immediately because economic activities are not going to be as buoyant as it would be if government was spending.
These stories and more coming up today on Africa Link.
Top story.
Hundreds of Kenyan students staged a protest march in the streets of Nairobi on Tuesday to call on President Uhuru Kenyatta to beef up security in the country and specifically in learning institutions. This is after nearly 150 students from Garissa University, close to the border with Somalia, were brutally murdered by Al-Shabaab militia in a terror attack last Thursday. In Nairobi, Alfred Kitty talked to some of the protesters and filed this report.
We have come to take a petition to the president so that he can boost security in our universities. We believe it's going to help if the president is truly a Kenyan leader. He should listen to us because in the constitution, he's the armed force commander. So he should protect us as young citizens and the future leaders.
That was Nelson Achola, a student at the Technical University of Nairobi. Fellow student Monica Ahadi is worried about the future.
We want peace and we want to be secure in our campuses. We want to fulfill our dreams.
The students are opposed to the indefinite closure of Garissa University and instead want the government to upgrade it into a world-class learning institution. Felix Okumu, student leader at the University of Nairobi, sought confirmation of their demands from fellow students.
Do you agree that they must fix security?
Yes.
Do you agree that Garissa University cannot be closed down?
Yes.
Do you agree that a memorial stone must be set up for our lost comrades?
Yes.
Apart from petitioning the government to beef up security on their campuses, the students also want the government to pay the bereaved families more than $2,000 for each student who died in the attack.
You said you are going to buy coffins. You said you're going to provide ambulance. Do that. But in addition, the government must give each family 2 million shillings.
The Garissa University terror attack is widely seen as a wake-up call to government leaders to scale up their game. Adan Duale is a member of parliament for Garissa and leader of government business in parliament. He had this warning for Al-Shabaab sympathizers.
We recognize the reality of collaborators amongst our communities. And we will, with immediate effect, commence to identify them, to document them, and to expose all the members, the financiers, and sympathizers of Al-Shabaab within the next 1 month.
The pledge by political leaders in Kenya's northeast, where Garissa is located, to curb the radicalization of youth in mosques comes just a day after President Uhuru Kenyatta urged the religious leaders to take responsibility for their teachings.
The time has come for us to be honest with ourselves and indeed each other. The radicalization that breeds terrorism is not conducted in the bush at night. It occurs in the full glare of day, in homes, in madrasas, and in mosques with rogue imams.
14 terror suspects have been arraigned in a Nairobi court. They were arrested in different places of worship and educational institutions on Sunday and Monday.
Alfred Kitty reporting from Nairobi. Uhuru Kenyatta said on Saturday anger at the massacre should not lead to the victimisation of anyone in Kenya. A reference to the country's Muslim and Somali minorities. But Kenyatta also said that Kenya would retaliate for the killings. Isaac Mugabe asked Leslie Lefko from rights group Human Rights Watch how concerned she was that measures enacted by Kenyan security forces could hit innocent civilians as well as Al-Shabaab militants.
What we've seen in the past is very poor performance by the security forces. We see operations in villages or neighborhoods where they round up men and boys, beat them. Often you see arbitrary detentions and other kinds of violence against civilians. And this has been, unfortunately, a very alarming pattern by the security forces for years. And I think it's a pattern that has continued over the last few years with the Al-Shabaab threat in Kenya. And this is our main concern, is that after this Garissa attack, the Kenyan government may pursue the same strategy that they've used in the past and target civilians as well as the Al-Shabaab militants who are actually responsible for the attacks.
Don't you think that in the interest of national security, Kenya has to deal with internal threats with some sort of heavy-handedness, if I may say, like the way countries like the US have dealt with the Al-Qaeda threats in the past?
I think that experience and history shows that the heavy-handed strategies used by governments to react to security or terrorist threats often aren't the most effective. If the Kenyan security forces use lawful methods, if they use competent intelligence operations and prosecute the people who are responsible, this is the best way to ensure security, not collective punishment against entire communities. Let's remember that Kenya's Somali and Muslim communities make up a large proportion of the Kenyan population. And these are people who the Kenyan police and military need to work with. They need to get cooperation from these communities. And if they are going around beating and detaining and abusing people, who is going to cooperate with them?
More youth in Kenya, especially in the northeastern part of the country, are joining the ranks of Al-Shabaab. What could be the underlying factors that have led them to join the militants?
There's still a lot of research that needs to be done to understand exactly what the patterns of recruitment and radicalization of Kenyans in Kenya has been. But certainly we and other organizations have seen that the history of Kenyan security of force abuses in Northeast Kenya is a factor in creating anger, frustration, and other grievances among Kenyan Somalis and Kenyan Muslims. The northeast of Kenya is an area that has long been marginalized economically and politically from the rest of Kenya, from Nairobi. It's an area where communities have experienced serious human rights violations for decades with no accountability by the Kenyan security forces. So it's not hard to understand why frustrated and angry youth in some of these communities might be tempted to join Al-Shabaab.
Al-Shabaab has vowed further bloodshed inside Kenya due to what it said is the continued persecution of Muslims. In your opinion, are Muslims persecuted in Kenya? I mean, have they been denied their rights?
I think there has been growing tensions within Kenya on religious and ethnic lines over the last few years. Some of these tensions are deep-seated. As I mentioned, they go back to independence. The Kenya's Somalis, for example, have experienced discrimination and problematic human rights treatment for decades. I think that the tensions between Christians and Muslims are more recent and have really been, say, growing over the last 10 years, in large part because of the abusive counterterrorism operations by the Kenyan security forces. So I think that Al-Shabaab is seeing these divisions in Kenya and it's trying to exploit them.
Leslie Defcow from Human Rights Watch speaking there with AfricaLink's Isaac Mugabe.
Africa Link, every weekday on DW Deutsche Welle.
Ghana will soon be able to access the first instalment in a loan from the International Monetary Fund. The West African nation's economy was once a rising star, but has lately been troubled by a currency that has lost nearly a third of its value. a steep public deficit and an electricity crisis. The hope is that this IMF bailout deal will give Ghana the breathing space it needs to reboot its economy. From Accra, Isaac Kelechi reports.
The approval of the deal by the IMF board means that Ghana can now access the $918 million bailout deal, but not all at once, as the deal will be spread over 3 years. The first disbursement of about $100 million is expected to arrive at the Bank of Ghana in the coming weeks. The arrangement under the Extended Credit Facility is intended to support the West African nation's medium-term economic reform program. Joel Tujan Bennett led the IMF delegation as the negotiations were concluded.
The program will basically rest on three main pillars. First, restraining and prioritizing a public expenditure with a transparent budget process. Second, increasing revenue collection for the budget. And third, the strengthening of the effectiveness of the monetary policy of the central bank in order to achieve lower inflation over the medium term.
Bennett said the deal was also intended to expand social protection programs for the poor. But despite this, economic analyst Courage Mati believes many Ghanaians will suffer economic hardship this year as a result of the deal.
Economic activity for the year will be subdued. And then ordinary man out there who is expecting some employment here and there may not get it immediately because economic activities are not going to be as buoyant as it would be if government was spending, you know. Besides, we also expect on the revenue side, the government would put in some measures to rake in more revenue. This includes some tax measures, levies, and so on. And this is another effect on the real income, the disposable income of the ordinary man out there. I think it's going to be a tough year, even for the ordinary man.
Ghana is currently struggling to fix an energy crisis that is putting pressure on businesses to survive. The president of the Ghana Chamber of Commerce, Seth Ejeba, says the government needs to prioritize using parts of the credit facility to solve the energy crisis so that businesses can continue with their operations and support the economy in the coming years.
It looks as if things are not working. That is why the economy is going down. And if we are not able to do the structures, no matter the amount of money we put into the system, it will still get back to the drain. So we have to do our homework well. The second thing is that if we are able to address the issue of power and we are able to give people money at a very affordable prices, Ghanaian businesses will come back to life again.
The country's 2015 budget has already been reviewed significantly. Major cuts in government spending are taking place and efforts are being made to raise more revenue through taxes. These moves, experts say, played a major role in the IMF approving the deal for Ghana. Persuading ordinary Ghanaians to support the deal and endure the impending hardship is now a major priority for President John Mahama.
The success of this extended credit facility will depend principally on ourselves, not on the IMF, not on the World Bank, or not on our development partners. It means that we must exercise fiscal discipline and we must live within our means.
Civil society groups are warning against corruption within government if the deal is to benefit Ghanaians in the long term. Vitus Azim is the executive director of the anti-corruption group Ghana Integrity Initiative.
It's not enough for you to give us the money and sit back and say, well, let's just do it the way they want. So I think that the emphasis on complying with the conditions that both Ghana government and its citizens have agreed on with the IMF should be implemented. Transparency, accountability and participation. They should account to the people.
In the next few days, managers of Ghana's ailing economy will get to work to fix it with the help of the IMF credit facility. Their efforts will be closely watched.
Isaac Kelechi reporting there from Accra.
Behind the headlines.
We heard earlier in the program how attacks by Islamist militants are a potential source of tension in Kenya between Muslim and Somali minorities and the rest of the population. We've returned now to Kenya to hear about the efforts by Muslims to defuse friction between people of different faiths. As James Shimagula reports in Behind the Headlines.
During the 3 days of the International Africa Islamic Conference in the Kenyan capital Nairobi, speaker after speaker quoted verses from the Holy Quran portraying the correct Islamic ethics and values. Strong messages of promoting peace, tolerance, and building bridges of understanding between Muslims and people belonging to other religious communities were extensively highlighted by the speakers. At the end of the conference, Kenyan participants agreed that time had come for Muslims and Christians, as well as other religious groups, to unite to fight terrorism. Kenya's Foreign Affairs Minister Amina Mohamed explains how terrorism can be fought.
By coming together, by staying together, by not allowing anybody or anything to come between, by standing firm against all evil. So we have now full evidence that this evil people want to interfere with the way that we have been developing, with our values. They want to change our way of life, and we are not going to let them do that.
The conference is organized annually by the Nairobi-based Journey of Faith Africa, an independent Kenyan Islamic group. Its aim was to promote good understanding of Islamic issues among Muslims and non-Muslims. The Nairobi conference gathered speakers from all parts of the world. Among the people invited to speak was the group's chairman and founder, Sheikh Saeed Ragia from Canada. Al-Haji Adan Wachu, Secretary General of the Supreme Council of the Kenya Muslims, illustrates some ways of fighting terrorism.
By working together, by passing information to the government, and by alerting our people to report any stranger they think is not up to anything good.
In the background of speeches by one of invited guests, Rahma Wanjiru, who participated in the conference, emphasized that united religious groups can fight terrorism.
I believe it's possible for Muslims and Christians to come together to fight terrorism. It's important if we can come together because we are worshipping one true God and we have the same commandment of not killing others who are innocent.
Mariam Kivunja, a high school teacher still remembering the deadly Garissa attack, pointed out that interaction by religious groups was a powerful human tool that can fight terrorism.
It's very important that we interact to bring peace in this part of the world. If we unite for the sake of humanity, we will know that these are just a group of people who are hijacking Islam to be able to perpetrate what they believe in.
Sheikh Abdi Latif Abdi Karim, representing the Kenya Council of Imams, looks at terrorism from a different perspective.
The dangers I see in terrorism, their objective, they want to divide us on a religious line. We've seen it in many countries. We don't want it to happen here. Dividing people on religious lines also is a terrible thing in any country. We are trying on our part, but now the world has become a global village. The youth have access to information through different media, including the mass media, the social media. There are certain things, of course, which are out of our control, and the youth being inquisitive, they tend also to venture into this media.
James Shimagula in Kenya. There is growing unease over the fate of a pro-democracy activist in Zimbabwe known for his public criticism of President Robert Mugabe. The activist, Itai Zamorai, went missing a month ago, and at the time both the European Union and the United States urged the Zimbabwean authorities to investigate his disappearance. But colleagues and lawyers of the missing man say little has been done in the meantime to find him. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Activist Itai Zamorai has been missing since early March. He is believed to have been abducted by state agents. Since then, there has been a court ruling that state agents must report regularly to the NGO Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights regarding progress in their efforts to locate him. Lloyd Parsi is one of those who had been demonstrating with Zamorai. He told me the security situation for critics of the Zimbabwean president has deteriorated noticeably.
As a group, we are no longer safe. We are being followed by cars which do have incomplete number plates. These cars are actually often being seen in our neighborhood, we being alerted by friends that you should not come home. It is not safe. So if ever you heard a dog barking by night, you don't even know where to start from. So we just sleep with the windows open or with plans to escape if ever anything happens.
Until his disappearance last month, Dzamara, a former journalist, had been demonstrating and calling for the resignation of President Robert Mugabe. He accused Africa's oldest leader of failing to prop up the Zimbabwean economy and abusing human rights. Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa has denied allegations that the government was involved in the disappearance of the missing activist.
We are a democratic society, and anybody in this country who commits crime must account for the crime they commit. This is why we have the institution of Zimbabwe Republic Police to deal with those who commit crimes of this nature. Everything must be done to apprehend and bring to book whoever is responsible.
Despite that assurance given by Vice President Mnangagwa to Parliament, 4 weeks down the line, there is no official comment on the whereabouts of Dzamara. Lizwe Njamela of Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights says not enough is being done.
Inasmuch as there are statements by authorities that they are investigating, so far we haven't had any updates in terms of what exactly is being done. But we also believe that the state has the capacity actually to do all sorts of investigations that are actually needed. And so far we are not feeling it. We are not feeling the efforts in terms of actually trying to find him. And what is at odds is that actually the suspicion points to state agents having abducted him.
Zimbabwe has a history of politically motivated abductions. In 2008, dozens of citizens were abducted mainly for their political activism. They spent weeks at undisclosed locations where they were routinely tortured by state security agents. They were later brought to court to face charges of plotting to unseat President Mugabe. The courts refused to prosecute, saying the abductees' rights had been violated when they were denied access to food, medication, and legal representation while in detention. Now there are fears that Itai Dzamara may also be a victim of torture by persons as yet unknown.
Columbus Mavungo with that report.
Opinion.
Earlier in our program, we heard that Kenyan students have been protesting about the inability of their government to keep them safe from militant attacks. But how powerful a voice do you think students have in today's Kenya? Let us know your thoughts in an SMS to country code 49160957595510 or an email to feedback.africa@dw.de or an old-fashioned letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. We'll air your comments in a future edition of Your Say here on Africa Link every Friday. And you might just win yourself a great DW prize for having Your Say. Before we leave you, a reminder of our top stories. Hundreds of Kenyan students marched through downtown Nairobi on Tuesday to honour those who died in an attack on a university by Islamist militants and to press the government for better security. Ghana will shortly be able to access credit under a bailout deal agreed with the International Monetary Fund. And there is growing unease over the fate of a pro-democracy activist in Zimbabwe who disappeared a month ago and has not been seen since. There we end this edition of Africa Link. Abu Bakar Jallo will be here at this time tomorrow. Do join him if you can. This is Jesse Wingard in Bonn. Goodbye.